Welcome to Sober Dad Crew, the podcast where we talk about all things dad, sobriety, recovery, parenting, music, tattoos, and more. For more information or to get in touch, visit SoberDadCrew.com. With this episode's guest, we expand a little bit and de-emphasize the dad component, but it has always been the goal of Sober Dad Crew to explore sobriety and recovery in the many forms it can take. With that said, I first learned of Emily Davis and the Murder Police when the band was opening for Bad Religion in 2019. I checked out the band and loved the music, and then I followed our guest Emily Davis on Instagram, where she is very open about her journey of mental health and sobriety. Emily Davis, welcome to Sober Dad Crew.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm thrilled. Like I said, I sort of discovered the band and then I heard your voice, and you have this kind of amazing, huge voice that fronts the band, and I just really kind of instantly fell in love with you guys, and really I believe in your little band from Texas.
Thanks.
I think you guys are awesome. Can you tell me a little bit about your sobriety journey?
Yeah, I've been sober for just hit 2 years at the beginning of the month. I'm a COVID sober knot of sorts. What led up to my there's a number of things that led up to it, but COVID presented a good opportunity, I think, whether I realized it at the time or not, to get sober. And so a lot of the people I look up to musically or otherwise that I aspire to be like, they've been sober. And so that also served as some pretty good motivation as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. And like I said, you've been very open on Instagram is where I've really seen you, and about also sort of past mental health stuff. Are you, you know, willing to talk about some of that as well?
Sure. I think, you know, it took me a while to be open really with both things, but sobriety, it was important to me to wait like a year before I made mention of anything, because I had tried and failed so many times and I didn't want to put it out there only to fail again. And I wanted to make sure that my motivations at the time were right. So that's part of it. As far as mental health, it's been something that I've dealt with for my entire life. When I was 27, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I'm type 2, so I verge more on the depressive side than the manic side, but I still occasionally have hypomania instead of mania. I have ADHD as well, and anxiety. So it's a fun little bundle of
the cocktail.
Yeah. But yeah, that's what I'm dealing with.
Yeah, thank you. And I really am a believer in openness and telling stories. And my sobriety comes out of depression and migraine headaches that were misdiagnosed for years, which was really chronic depression. So I think there's so much misunderstanding. A lot of healthcare people look in the wrong directions. My doctor even said, she's like, wow, I really missed the mark on that one, which like I appreciated the openness about that. Where she really said like, wow, I was just looking in the wrong direction because I like presented really healthy. She mm-hmm. said, how are you doing? I'd say I'm good, but I really wasn't, you know, I was struggling, but I presented well. I was taking care of my kids. At that point, I was married. So it didn't seem on the surface like anything was wrong, but really, you know, if she had dug a little deeper, and that's even what she said, I should have dug deeper to sort of see what was beneath and pushed harder. So I hope that healthcare providers are doing that a little more.
Yeah.
So one of the first songs of yours that I really, really fell in love with is The Only Way Out. And I really just love that lyric and I love the message. And it really does feel, in my understanding of your story, or at least when I interpret, you put this song in the world, so I get to interpret a little bit.
Yeah.
For me,
yeah.
Like there's like a light at the end of the tunnel, right? But you have to just look and see that you can get there, which is part of the motivation behind, you know, doing this podcast for people. Is there a little origin story on that song? Or
sure, I love when songs are open and become, maybe they always start with something. There's a root from which they grow. But I always like it when there's a song that is just open-ended enough that somebody could kind of take it and apply it to their own life. And so occasionally I'll try to write songs in that manner. There wasn't really an agenda with that one. Truthfully, we were on tour when I started writing it, and I was dealing with hypomania. which is something that I've only ever dealt with a couple of times. And it was a pretty significant bout of it where I was trying to, like, I knew something. I didn't know I had bipolar at the time, but I knew there was something wrong with my brain. And I was trying to figure out what it was. And it felt like very consumptive of myself. And it felt like, because of whatever it was I was dealing with at the time, which later was made clear to me, it felt like I was very much looking inward and I was having a hard time escaping myself. And so empathy, I think, for humans is vital for a lot of reasons. Obviously, it helps us keep in touch with our humanity, but as a survival strategy, empathy, and maybe like a boring functional sense, it helps us to distract ourselves. It helps us to forge relationships with one another to survive. But for me, in that particular instance, looking outside of myself accomplished the desire to get out of myself. And so if I decided to try to empathize with somebody else and to look at their needs and try to see the world from their perspective, even as during the time when I was really just sick, it completed that objective. I was able to look outside of myself and escape myself. So it's kind of where the lyric came from. The only way out of yourself is to look out into somebody else, into the eyes of somebody else, into the heart of somebody else. I hope being that specific doesn't ruin the message for you, but that's kind of where it came from.
No, I mean, it really kind of supports it, because I remember just always feeling stuck in my brain. Like, I am really jammed in my own head, and like, I just can't get out of it. I couldn't get out of it. So I think it's supportive of my thought. And I like also that art can have multiple interpretations and messages for people. I think that's sort of one of the great things about art. And I think must be cool as a songwriter to put things out there and know that, like, they have meaning for people, and people are, you know, it helps them. They like turn it up in their car, right? They're having a crap day, and maybe they turn on your song and it makes it better. I mean, I think that's pretty great.
I mean, it honestly never fails to blow my mind. I know that maybe that's what you would expect me to say, but, you know, we've never spoken before. This is my first time meeting you, and you love a song of mine and you get to tell me about it. And I think that's super dope. And there are days where it's easy to like feel very limited and feel like you're not really impacting the way you want to, or your art's not taking you to the places that you had hoped. But in having conversations like this and in being able to interface with people and hear their stories and see how my art is registered with them, that's, I mean, amazing to me. So I'm very appreciative of it.
Yeah. When did you start playing music and writing songs?
I've always kind of just made up songs. I feel like it was a way for me to parse my thoughts. I speak very fast, as you probably are aware, having spoken with me now for 9 minutes. And sometimes I feel like thoughts just kind of rumble out of my head. And it's nice to be able to take the time to think of what it is I want to say. And I can do that. I can slow down and do that in the songwriting process. And so I don't know if that was what I was exactly looking to do when I was younger, but I felt like it was a different way to communicate, and I liked that. I mean, so I've always sung. Since I was very young, have been making up songs. I mean, actually starting to put pen on paper and cultivate something, I was probably 10, but I hadn't landed on an instrument at that point yet. So it wasn't really an endeavor until I turned 14 or 15 years old. That's when I decided to pick up guitar. I wanted to be able to play an instrument to accompany the songs I was wanting to write and sing. So guitar ended up being the instrument I sat on. And so started playing it when I was 14. And probably by the time I was 15, I had a handful of songs that I was working on.
That's cool. I touched on this in my previous episode with my guest. And, you know, Jeff Tweedy has talked a lot about this and the notion of art and musicians and sort of what I think is a myth of creativity coming out of darkness. Or are you doing it in spite of the struggle? Do you have a thought on that?
For me, creativity comes out of an impulse, certainly out of darkness. I mean, a lot of my too much of my material is dark. I'd love to be able to inject some levity into my songwriting. It's just been hard. Certainly art comes out of darkness or gritty emotions, I guess. But for me, when it really surfaces, this doesn't happen all the time, but certainly when I'm maybe the most productive is I'll have an overwhelming impulse to get a thought out of me. And when I have these impulses, I mean, they extend beyond just writing music. I mean, the nature of ADD often encompasses impulsivity. So I'll have an idea or I'll get a line in my head that I really like or a subject that I really like, or I'll hear kind of like an idea in my head for a chord progression and I can't take myself completely away from it. And so it gnaws at me until I'm able to release it. So, and that doesn't sound as inspirational or pretty, but it truly is just a matter of me trying to relieve myself of this thing in my head that I can't get out. And so I've become very focused on it. And once it can get it out of me, then I can kind of just go on with the rest of my day. And so I think that's part of it.
Does it come out pretty fully crafted, or are you like a go back and edit kind of, like, as a writer? I'm definitely a go back and edit kind of person, but I get like there's all kinds of different creative ways.
I think when I was younger, songs would just fall out of me, probably because they weren't very good. But I think my standards have increased a lot. But every now and then, a song will come out of me. And for the most part, it's done. And that's really nice. But there are other times where I have songs that are just in limbo. And I mean, I have 3 or 4 songs that I've just have been sitting and they're incomplete for the better part of a year. And it seems like the times I've tried to return to them, it's not productive. It's stressful. And I don't want a song to be born out of that energy. So I might mess with it and then realize today's not the day. I'll come back when I feel like I have a lead. And so, especially in recent years, I think it might be a combination of me just being too critical on myself and wanting to make sure I'm doing something different and not just regurgitating material. The older I get, the more songs kind of just extend and it takes me a while to complete them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That makes sense. I mean, I'll often just walk around with pen and paper, trying not to be awkward at work when I'm like walking around and like trying to write something. But you just wait, you know, waiting for that one little piece, and then it all kind of falls into, it's like a domino of like, oh, yeah, there was like the crux idea I needed, and it frames up everything else after it. So I'm always like interested really to hear other people's process.
Yeah.
You know, little pivot here. So being in the music scene, obviously, you know, you're playing in bars, you guys are getting ready to go on tour, right?
Yeah.
In Canada coming up. Yep. How is like sobriety in the music scene on tour? You know, is that a challenge, or is, you know, you're with the band and they're your family, right? Your husband's in the band with you.
Yeah.
So that's obviously got to be a supportive element there.
You know, we haven't played a ton of shows since I've been sober. I mean, we've played maybe 10 or 11 shows, which I know isn't a lot. There's been a number of reasons for that. This is really the first tour we've been on since we toured with Bad Religion. We had a couple of like weekend warrior dints. We did a little run last year with Jim Ward. And then we did a little run in Albuquerque, Santa Fe earlier this year. And then recently we did a couple Texas shows. But this is really the first tour that we've been on in almost 3 years or in 3 years. And so I can tell you, I guess I can answer that and I can't, because I haven't been in a prolonged touring experience yet, so we get to test those waters here next month. But
yeah, are you excited and nervous about that?
For sure. Also, it's a different country, so
right.
I know it's been challenging in that alcohol served a handful of purposes like anybody, but a big one for me was being able to escape the moment, escape myself. You know, that was something that I, for whatever reason, I feel the constant need to do. And so at shows, like any musician, you develop a habit of drinking prior to your set. And I, you know, a lot of us try to find that perfect sweet spot where we're mentally lubricated, but we're not trashed. Although there have been shows that I've played trashed, but trying to find a sweet spot where you're taking enough out of yourself that you're not so terribly self-aware and overthinking and sensory overload isn't, you know, that was kind of the purpose for me, I think, for drinking partially. And so I've been deprived of that recently, and you have to readapt. I think the benefit is maybe I'm better, maybe not, I don't know, but but if, you know, you go to a bar and you're just so blisteringly sober.
Yeah.
I don't know if that resonates with you, the word blistering, when it comes to, it's just,
I mean, I've been rocking seltzer and coffee, you know, for almost 13 years, and I'm definitely the wallflower guy at the show. Yeah. You know, yeah. I'm in the back kind of, you know, because I'm a pretty reserved person. Mm-hmm. And I know some musicians have talked about that too, where they're actually kind of shy. Right. Yeah. And so there's that whole like, oh, now I got to get on stage.
Yeah.
And people are expecting maybe even a persona, right? They've interpreted the song, so they have a sense.
Yeah.
Of they think they know you. I saw this interview with Bruce Springsteen once, and you know, somebody said to him, you know, I've heard your songs, I think I know you, do you? And he's like, no, you absolutely do not know me, you know, I'm telling stories up here.
Yeah, for sure. I deal with social anxiety too, and beer and whiskey and occasionally tequila certainly helped with that. I have a hard time focusing in conversations, and there are certain oh my God, drunk people. When you're drunk and some drunk person wants to come up to you and talk to you, you can just blabber at each other endlessly, and it's wonderful. But when I'm just incredibly sober, very, very sober, dry as hell, and somebody comes up to me and a well-meaning person wants to have a conversation with me, but they're doing the whole repeating themselves thing, and I don't know, I have those conversations now, and it's they give me a lot of panic, and before I didn't really have to deal with that. So there's a number of ways that my social anxiety manifests. It's been, I guess the long and short is it's been hard. I want to adapt to it. It's important to adapt to it, because the alternative is going back to a lifestyle that was killing me mentally, at least. And I don't want to be in that position again. It was a lifestyle that I enjoyed for many years, and I have some good memories on, but towards the end, it got pretty dark, and it took me a lot of effort to try and get out of it. So it's an either or situation. Either you concede defeat and acknowledging that those are difficult situations, and you revert back to old habits, or you figure out ways to thrive within them. And so I'm still trying to figure that out.
Yeah. I mean, I think really what that is, you know, recovery is right. It's, you don't recover. It really is a journey. Yeah. Right. And so, you know, as a parent, there's stressors. As a, you know, in my job, it's high pressure, right? So there's all these things that come at you, and you do have to learn how to adapt. And, you know, for me, year on year, you know, it's almost 13 years. It really is sort of, I can't at this point imagine the other way. But in the early years, it's pretty easy to get in your own way. I always felt like, man, I got to fight to stay out of my own head, because I spend too much time in my own head. So I have to like stay outside of there and then just move forward. So that notion of like just one day and the next day and the next day really, for me, really helps. And now I have, you know, thousands of days, but everyone has to have a first day.
Yeah.
And everyone has to have tomorrow. And so you just, you know, you try and find your way through that, and hopefully you have community, family that really supports that.
Yeah, and I do.
And that's cool. So now I'm going to pivot, because we should talk about Bad Religion.
Okay.
Because you really love Bad Religion.
I do.
Was that sort of your first band that you loved, or your first punk band that you loved? Like, what's your, you know, how did you get to Bad Religion?
Certainly the first punk band that I loved. I was raised in a conservative Christian household, and so my exposure to a lot of music was limited. My parents did love 70s rock, and so I got a lot of that, and that was great. But as far as music much far outside of that. It was very limited. And so in high school, I had friends who were, I liked hanging out with the alternative kids, and I liked hanging out with the goth kids and the punk kids and whatever. But I never really spent any time trying to get into punk. I was getting into like new wave and getting into some goth and some, you know, 80s, whatever. But punk was never something that like, I was like, okay, let's do some digging here. I have an ex who is very much into Bad Religion. And when I was in high school, introduced me to them, made me a couple mixed CDs with probably 25 songs on them. And I, pardon the pun, I started listening to them religiously. And before long, they became my favorite band. Yeah. And so that's kind of where it took me. They've also been a gateway drug to other punk bands that I like now. But they, for a long time, I didn't consider myself a punk fan. I considered myself a Bad Religion fan.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing I like about your band, there's like definitely some like sort of country influence there, which definitely is kind of a punk thing. Like Social Distortion brings that in. I don't know if that's sort of the Texas thing or what it is, but it's a cool blend that you guys have created.
Yeah, I don't know if it's Texas. I definitely like folk artists. I think Southern rock was a big influence of mine when I was very young. I don't listen to it so much now, but you know, there were artists that my parents really enjoyed and listened to a lot, like the Doobie Brothers or the Allman Brothers or other ZZ Top, etc. And so those things, they have a Southern tinge to them. And that I think a lot of my first earliest influences come from those kind of those bands. It very well could be. I mean, I live in El Paso, and El Paso is not at all like the rest of Texas. We're basically an extension of New Mexico. And so we don't have like a big country music scene in El Paso. I mean, there's people here who like country music. There's a couple country bars, but it's not at all an overwhelming thing. And I mean, as far as country music, you know, I like a little bit of outlaw country, but that's really, I mean, I like Dolly Parton. That's really the extent of it. So
yeah, I mean, it's hard not to like Dolly Parton, like in all that she does, because she's just like a super cool human being.
Yeah.
One song, and it's more of a recent song for you guys, is Why Weren't They Stunned, which was, you know, seems really one of your more overtly political songs. Mm-hmm. In a response to a really real moment in this country. Was that one that kind of just poured out in the moment, or did you feel like you kind of had to make a statement about that? Or,
well, it started with a bass line that I wrote, and you know, it was a product of COVID. And I'm sure a lot of people were relying too heavily on plagues and plague imagery. And so, I mean, I fell victim to that. But, you know, for me, the idea of, I draw a lot of inspiration from the Bible, even though I'm not Christian. I just think there's a lot of interesting, if you look at it as a literary text, there's a lot of interesting matter in there. And so the idea of, you know, ancient Egyptians seeing these horrific plagues, and of, you know, of course they weren't just sitting there chilling, but they enough wasn't done to stop them from continuing, right? And so if you take that imagery and you place it on modern America, and you see so much of what's going on in our country with regard to COVID, but even beyond that, a big part of that, honestly, in that song is climate change. But you just see these natural disastrous events, or you see like a widening disparity between the classes, people that are huge encampments of people that are starving on the streets, just like these ridiculous things that we see, and they just exist and nothing is done about it. That, I mean, it kind of just blows my mind that for years we've been warned about cataclysmic events regarding like viruses or things of that nature that we are so unprepared for. And we've talked about it for decades now and done nothing to prepare for it. And so I guess it was born out of that frustration of, why do we see things in front of us and we don't do anything about them? Are we so ingrained in our ways and in our systems that we can't tackle something and act radically to address something? Because we're not. And it's baffling.
Yeah, so, I mean, you're preaching to the choir with me on that. And I also think our economic system is really established to also make it hard for people to to stand up. People say, let's have a general strike. I'm like, how many people can actually just have the privilege to just take a paid day off?
Yeah.
So many people don't.
Yeah.
Right. And so the system really does exist pretty well to keep the economy running in a way that benefits the minority. And that minority of people seems perfectly happy with global warming to continue as long as, you know, they're making money right now and they don't seem to care about their kids and their grandkids or their great grandkids. Yeah, it's, you know, it's kind of wild. And it, as a parent, I sort of struggle with that. I look and I have the future for my kids going to look like,
yeah,
if we don't do anything. But also, you know, I work all day. So it's, you know, I used to feel like an activist and I don't. And so I, you know, I struggle with that. I feel like, am I doing enough out there in the world to try and at least move the needle like a little bit?
Right.
I don't know. It you know, so that's, you know, that's something I sort of still struggle with. And
yeah.
And it, you know, and I think it just can be hard to do that. So back to the tour. I know you guys were looking for, you know, help and support. Can people still help you? I know you're able to get a van, which is awesome, but I'm a believer in the little bands and helping the little bands out there. So like, how can people support you all?
Appreciate that. I mean, probably the ideal way is to purchase one of our albums on Bandcamp. You can do that at emilydavis.bandcamp.com. Get the added benefit of providing us funds, but also getting something in return. If you already have that, or if you just want to throw some cash our way, we have Cash App, we've got Venmo, PayPal. So any kind of donation would help, and we would appreciate it for sure.
Yeah, that's awesome. So when does the tour kick off?
We leave October 19th.
So you're driving?
No.
No. So you're flying up and then getting a van. I was wondering, because I was like, well, upstate New York, if you're driving, is on the way, and we got fine beds for you guys. But so you're flying up there and then renting a van. And
yeah.
So do you have anything on the table after that one?
Yeah, I'm currently working on a solo EP. Been in the process of recording it. I'm undecided as to whether or not I want to add some more songs to it. I currently have four that are recorded. I'm intending to record a fifth that I recently wrote. I'm working with a local label, hopefully, in trying to get that out soon. So it kind of just depends on a number of things, but I'm trying to take my time on it. I have this bad habit of rushing releases and then being sad when they don't really make the impact I'm hoping. So I really want to just kind of take my time with this and make sure it's done correctly. My band, we're currently working on a handful of new songs as well. So ideally we'd have some kind of release next year. So there are a couple things, new music, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And thank you so much for taking the time and being so open and sharing. And good luck on tour. I hope you get to upstate New York at some point, because my teenage daughter is a huge fan. And so I would love to take her to see you all. You know, and she's also a kid that's, you know, had recovery stuff. So I was like connecting her to music that can speak to that and people that can speak to that. So, you know, once again, thank you so much.
Yeah, of course. I appreciate you wanting to chat with me.
Absolutely. Have a great night.
You too. Take care.
All right. Thanks. Thanks for listening. For more information, for links to any music or books we talked about, or to buy some Sober Dad Crew merchandise, please visit SoberDadCrew.com.